Spending is down, saving is up.
Is this another sign of the economic nightmare known as deflation?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrienne Hill. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Monday, January 30th.
Coming up, the war on food stamps.
A conversation with the head of NASCAR.
And one solution to the European debt crisis, it's chocolate.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
The government said this morning that consumer spending stayed flat in December, but personal incomes were up, and it appears Americans are saving that extra cash. For more, let's bring in Julia Coronado. She's chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas, and she joins us now from New York, as she does every Monday. Good morning.
Good morning.
So we're saving a little bit more. Is that a good thing?
That's a good thing and a bad thing. On the one hand, it's great that consumers are now living within their means to a greater extent than they did in the past. So when you see a burst of spending, then they slow down and rein it in and save a little bit more, and that's good. On the other hand, it does mean that slower growth for the economy is probably with us for a while.
And put this together with some of the other trends we're seeing. Nobody wants to really buy stuff right now unless they're getting deep discounts. People are holding out on buying houses because they think maybe they'll get a better deal going forward. Isn't this possibly textbook deflation?
Well, this is exactly the scenario that keeps the Fed awake at nights and one of the reasons that they've been determined to stay very aggressive. Indeed, if consumers know that they're going to get a better deal next year, next month, then why spend now? And so deflation can be very insidious that way and lock in lower and lower spending. On the other hand, you know, consumers' wages just aren't rising. And so if they don't have greater purchasing power, they can't go out and spend. So I'm not sure that the Fed can fix that one quickly.
And Julia, we hear more about inflation than deflation. Is inflation still a concern for you?
You know, again, we can see bursts of inflation like we did last year, usually driven by global developments in energy markets. But it's not going to last as long as consumers don't have the wages to absorb it. So when we saw inflation last year, consumers just stopped spending. And that itself took the wind out of commodity prices. So there's a very limited extent to which I think we could really see inflation rise over the long term.
Julia Coronado, chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas, thanks as always.
It's a pleasure.
In his State of the Union address, President Obama sketched out a plan to help homeowners who are current with their mortgages to refinance. We're still waiting for details of the program, but the idea sounds pretty good to Alan Sloan. He's editor at large at Fortune magazine and joins us now. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Adrienne.
So why do you think this proposal is such a big deal?
Because if it's done the right way, it amounts to Wall Street bailing out honorable Main Street homeowners whose tax money was used to bail out Wall Street. You'd make life easier for maybe 20 million families by reducing their monthly interest payments at no cost to the taxpayers. It's about $60 billion a year of economic stimulus. Also, it's obvious economic justice by helping people who through no fault in their own, can't refinance.
Now, explain, how is this Wall Street bailing out Main Street?
Because the money the homeowners would save, which will call on average $3,000 a year of interest, in effect comes out of the pockets of the holders of mortgage-backed securities. And these holders are predominantly the Federal Reserve and giant financial institutions that taxpayers bailed out. This is not the government bailing out people who've defaulted. This is honorable homeowners getting to refinance and paying their debts at 100 cents on the dollar. There's nothing not to like unless you own the mortgage-backed securities.
Fortune magazine's Alan Sloan, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Adrienne. It was my pleasure.
Florida has become the latest state to consider limiting what people can buy with food stamps. A state lawmaker there has authored a bill that would ban people from using food stamps to buy junk food. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer joins us now to talk about what's behind this food fight. Good morning, Nancy.
Hey, Jeremy.
Well, first, just remind us how food stamps work.
Sure. Actually, first, Jeremy, they're not called food stamps anymore. The food stamp program has been renamed the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. Hmm. And you did actually used to get paper stamps, but now recipients get a plastic card that they just swipe. The effect is the same, though. The government is buying your groceries. And that state legislator in Florida, she wants to be sure you're not using your food stamps to buy cookies, chips, and candy.
And Florida is not the only place trying to put limits on food stamps right now.
Right, exactly. Legislation limiting food stamp purchases has already been proposed and rejected in a few states, including Oregon, California, and Texas.
And Nancy, why is this big push against food stamps happening right now?
Well, Jeremy, food stamp usage is up by more than 60% since the start of the recession. So it is a hot topic. And I talked about why food stamp usage is up with Patrick Hughes. He's a policy analyst at Height Analytics.
On the state level, economic and housing woes typically go hand in hand with participation in programs like the federal food stamp program.
And of course, Jeremy, Florida has one of the highest foreclosure rates in the country. So it's really no surprise that it is among the top three food stamp recipients in the country.
Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer in Washington. Thanks, Nancy.
You're welcome.
Federal prosecutors say they may delete data from the file sharing site Mega Upload as soon as Thursday. The company says more than 50 million users could have their data erased from their personal storage space on the internet. The government says it's deleting the files because the space was used to share movies and music illegally. But what's it say about the safety of the cloud as a place to store and share things like our pictures? We called up Rick Ferguson. He's security expert at Trend Micro. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what are the risks to storing things like photos, information in the cloud?
I think it's only one of the risks that you do have to take into account when you're using a cloud service is the longevity and trustworthiness of your cloud provider. So, for example, if you're using a service from Apple with their iCloud service, you can place a much larger degree of trust in them as a provider. If you're talking about an example like Mega Upload, this is not a publicly listed company. It's not a company with a great pedigree. And therefore, you know, you should have consequently less trust in that provider and take other measures to protect your data.
Now, are there other risks involved in keeping my important information in the cloud?
I think the other consideration that a lot of people come up against when they're thinking of storing either personal or commercial data in the cloud is how secure is my data from the employees of that company? Do they store my data in an encrypted format, which means they can't get access to my data, or is it all freely available to those employees? I know some time back there was for example, a Google employee who had to be dismissed for inappropriately accessing information of Google customers, for example.
Now, does this all mean I shouldn't be storing my really important photos in the cloud?
No, absolutely not. I mean, it means that you should do your research before you make that commitment and make sure that the company that you're placing your trust in is deserving of that trust. Make sure they're going to treat your data carefully. Make sure they're going to respect your privacy and make sure that they're a company that you can trust.
Rick Ferguson is a security expert at Trend Micro. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
Now to the Marketplace global perspective, European leaders are meeting today in Brussels to try and move forward on a new treaty, one that would force European countries to keep their budgets in order. But as usual, things are not going exactly as planned. And this morning, that's thanks to Greece. Jan-Marc Vallehue is co-founder of Claire Invest Asset Management Fund. He's with us now to talk about this from Geneva, Switzerland. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. Well, first of all, just tell me if I've got this right. So European leaders, they're meeting in Brussels today, and the focus was supposed to be on this new treaty that forces countries to get their deficits under control. But none of that really matters until Greece makes a deal with its lenders so it can get more bailout money. Is that all correct?
Yes, absolutely. For the last maybe 4 weeks to a month, the Greek issue was off the radar. It was pretty much a done deal that the restructuring of the debt would go through. But unfortunately, as we are getting closer to the major deadline of the March 14 debt payment, we still have no deal. So therefore, all other news headlines have been pushed back, and the central issue right now coming back to the forefront is the Greek negotiations.
And so when this summit that is going on in Brussels is over, where are we going to be that's different from where we are now?
Well, I don't think this will be the end of the summits. European leaders have a history of enjoying the summits. So therefore, we'll have some more of those. This one will not solve anything. It might get them closer together, but looking at what's going on with the Greek negotiations, they can't get everybody to agree. So it's a difficult time.
Jan-Marc Vallehue is co-founder of Clarinvest Asset Management Fund, speaking with us from Geneva. Jan-Marc, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
France has proposed a new tax on the banks, charging them a little bit for every financial transaction. The BBC's Andrew Walker explains what the financial transaction tax is and why France is going ahead with it.
President Sarkozy has some big problems to tackle. Among them, his government is running a budget deficit. This financial transactions tax is labelled by some as a Robin Hood tax, as in it steals from the rich and gives to the poor.
Nous espérons récupérer pour le budget de l'État et donc réduire le déficit 1 milliard d'euros.
We hope the tax will generate 1 billion euros of new income and thus cut our budget deficit. What we want to do now is to push others into taking action by giving them an example.
In this case, the French president didn't spell out exactly what would be taxed, but officials have said it'll be trading in shares of stock, not bonds. And the French hope to set an example that will lead to other European countries adopting a similar tax. French banks oppose going it alone, fearing they'll lose business, perhaps to London. Britain already has a tax on share trading, but will not go along with a levy on other types of transactions. Political observers note President Sarkozy also faces an election and he's currently trailing in the opinion polls. Taxing the banks will be popular, and President Sarkozy says it will make a useful contribution to fixing the government's finances. I'm the BBC's Andrew Walker for Marketplace.
Well, one British company isn't waiting on politicians for a solution to the credit crunch. It's got its own sweet idea, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
No liquidity problems for this factory. Molten chocolate fairly pours down the production line, partly thanks to the new line of credit, the chocolate bond.
Our customers advance us some money, and while we're using the money that they've loaned us, we repay the interest to them in chocolate.
Angus Thirlwell of Hotel Chocolat offers his 100,000 mail-order customers a mouth-watering investment opportunity. Lend us $3,000 and we'll send you six large boxes of high-quality chocolate a year.
It deepens the relationship with our customers. And if I had a choice of who I'm going to pay interest to, a big bank or my lovely customers, well, it's an easy choice.
So far, his company has raised more than $7 million in this way to buy new machinery and expand its cocoa estate on the Caribbean island of St. Lucia. Anne Avis in London is one enthusiastic investor.
I'm a customer and I'm buying the chocolates anyway. And then to get paid almost a 7% return in chocolates when you stick the money in the bank, you barely get 3%, just seemed like a great idea.
And it's an even sweeter deal for Hotel Chocolat. The bond may yield almost 7% for the investor, but it obviously costs the company much less. And, says Angus Thirlwell, it does combat the credit crunch.
We're not subject to the vagaries of whether banks feel positive or negative about the overall economic outlook. We're more secure, more ring-fenced in a nice relationship with our own customers.
No worries about investors losing their appetite for this debt, he says. The interest on this loan will always be pretty tempting. Debt that doesn't leave a bitter taste, although it might add a few pounds to the customer's bottom line. In Huntingdon, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Well, Jeremy, with the Super Bowl less than a week away, I thought it was time to check in with the Animal Kingdom on their picks for the game.
Do they bet on the
Well, you remember like the octopus who kept picking the World Cup games? He was always right. He I think, died sadly. But I wanted to see what other animals were out there sort of picking the game.
Okay.
Here's what I tracked down. There's a sea lion in the Bronx Zoo who thinks the Giants are going to win. No surprise, New York.
How do we know that? Has the sea lion...
He nodded his head, I guess.
Okay, all right. That's fair enough.
A camel in New Jersey named Princess also picked the Giants. Now, she has a pretty good record. She's actually picked 5 of the last 6 Super Bowl champions. But again, she's a New Jersey resident, so we don't know.
In fairness, the Giants do play in New Jersey, so maybe she knows pretty well what's going on.
So on to the Georgia Aquarium, where 2 dolphins correctly predicted a Giants-Patriots matchup. But then, when they were asked to pick the Super Bowl victor, they came up with the Miami Dolphins. Those silly Dolphins don't know how football works.
They're not playing this year.
It's crunch time in Florida. Time for candidates to shake as many hands and kiss as many babies and smile for as many pictures as they possibly can. Tomorrow, voters in Florida will make their choice for a Republican presidential candidate. We wanted to know what the Florida business community has to say about the economy and the election. So for today's Midday Extra, we got in touch with Brian France. He's the CEO of NASCAR. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
What's the business condition in Florida right now?
Well, you know, I think it's been hard hit. I think that's pretty obvious with the foreclosure numbers, the unemployment, and alike. It's been there, California, and a few other states, particularly hard hit. I know we have a pro-growth governor who is very much focused on jobs. Obviously, the campaign's in full swing with the Republican Party through the state right as we speak, and it's tough. But our business is helping turn that around. Our attendance has been up at facilities in Daytona and down in South Florida. We're expecting a big Speed Weeks, one of the largest industry and sports draws in the country, will happen here in a few weeks in Daytona Beach.
Now, does the beat-up housing market and high unemployment rate in Florida affect NASCAR directly?
Sure. You know, look, we've got a whole lot of fans that are going through a big hartnership, and a lot of them live in Florida, and Tampa and Jacksonville, Orlando, even in South Florida, are big markets for the Daytona 500. So there's no question it makes it harder to, and in our events, have, you know, literally 200,000 people at once in multiple events throughout the month of February. So it has an impact, but fortunately the product is very strong, and we're working with our fan base to help in any way we can with hotel prices and tickets that we can discount if possible, and the track has done a great job with all that.
Now, what one thing do you think the presidential candidates need to understand about Florida's economy?
Well, I think the one thing is how diverse it is, and you know, and how many big urban markets that there really are, and there are different issues in different places. You know, Orlando, as an example, where I spend a lot of time, has not been as hard hit with the foreclosure crisis, although hit hard. But it's got the Space Coast right to the east of it. But how diverse it is, and how much the unpredictability has hurt the state of Florida, and I'm sure as much as any place that, you know, we operate a lot of businesses in Florida, and we need some predictability here, and we need some good leadership, and I'm hopeful that that's going to happen.
Now, when you hear what the candidates say they're going to do for Florida, do you believe them, or do you think they're just looking to win votes right now?
No, I largely believe them. And, you know, I think, Mitt Romney, has shown so much leadership in so many different areas that, you know, I'm optimistic with Mitt in particular that he understands how to get the economy working. So I'm optimistic that good things will happen.
So what qualities are you looking for in our next president?
I'm looking for general leadership. I keep hearing what's the one big magic bullet that somebody's going to do or not do to get the economy working? And the truth is there's not one thing that you can, one lever you can go pull. I think it's a combination of what direction, how you can take the country, how you can win over people on both sides of the aisle. That's, I think, where Mitt Romney has the best attributes. He knows how to work across both lines to get to the same place. So I'm looking for somebody who's going to unite the country, not keep this, you know, back and forth divisiveness that's going on.
Now, NASCAR does business all over the country. You've got races pretty much everywhere. Where do you see the biggest problems nationwide?
Well, I see them where the numbers show that they are in Michigan, California. We do a lot of business in California. Those are the states that we've had some bigger challenges than most. the Midwest part of the country. We're opening a casino here very shortly in a couple of weeks in Kansas City. Seems to be weathering it a little bit better. They've got an agricultural base and a few other things going in their favor. But I think it would be California, Michigan, and Florida for my money.
Brian France is the CEO of NASCAR. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
You don't hear much about nuclear power plants being built these days, but as soon as this week, federal regulators are expected to greenlight construction of two new nuclear power reactors in Georgia. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Troh reports.
The U.S. hasn't had a new nuclear reactor in more than 30 years, not since the Three Mile Island meltdown. Matthew Bunn at the Harvard Kennedy School says that changed the industry.
Costs escalated through the roof, and public support has not been that great.
It's been tough to raise the billions needed for new reactors. The Georgia project would add a third reactor to two already operating. All three will be run by a utility called the Southern Company. It got a financial boost from government subsidies.
The hope was to replace dirty coal with cleaner nuclear.
Was the hope. Sam Jaffe at IDC Energy Insights says the Georgia nuclear plant is a straggler from old policy, not the start of a new trend, because the entire utility industry has a new focus.
We're quickly heading towards one single generation source, which is natural gas.
Natural gas is cheap right now. Power plants that use it are not hard to build. And while there are public concerns over how we get that natural gas, namely fracking, people still don't fear that as much as a nuclear meltdown. I'm Eve Troh for Marketplace.
So we don't usually do the weather on Marketplace, but today I can tell you that the eastern half of the country is going to be relatively warm this week. And Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports this year's warm winter is sending the cost of home heating fuel way down.
Kyle Cooper tracks fuel supplies as managing director of research for IAF Advisors in Houston, where he says temperatures have routinely been in the 70s this January.
It's not so fun in July and August, but in the winter, yeah, it's not bad.
The winter's lower than normal demand for heating fuels like oil and natural gas is creating a glut. In fact, Cooper says the surpluses could become what he calls catastrophic.
We're on a path to actually exceed storage capacity by October or November. There's a chance there's literally no more room at the end.
The price for natural gas has dropped by 50% since September, and that helps electricity generators and refiners of gasoline.
The U.S. is now a net exporter of both gasoline and diesel fuel as a result of the competitive cost advantage that U.S. manufacturers now have as a result of this cheap natural gas.
Right now, Americans are paying about $2.50 for natural gas that costs Europeans $10. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
And finally, Adrian, to Middleton, Wisconsin, home of the National Mustard Museum. I don't know if you've ever been to the
No, but the I NMM. Wish I had.
Yeah, right. Well, it's in a bit of a financial squeeze right now. Apparently, they're not getting enough visitors these days. But according to the Wisconsin State Journal, the Mustard Museum is having some trouble paying back a $178,000 loan to Dane County. The collateral for the loan is, of course, the museum's prized mustard collection, which I think is worth more than $100,000.
So did an appraiser come in and set a value on the mustard
collection?
I don't
know. It did a little taste testing and really made sure that the mustards were indeed worth every penny. The county, though, would rather not go down that road. They don't want to take the mustard in exchange for cash, so they are going to give the museum a little extra time to catch up on payments.
Sounds like a plan.
Don't send me your letters about that. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrienne Hill. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.